For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, tonight we talk about the paradox of the gospel. And as I've been saying kind of since the very beginning, the thesis statement of Mark's gospel in Mark chapter 1, verse 1 is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Gospel just means the good news. And the good news that God has to offer humanity begins with the work that Jesus did in his 3.5 years of ministry and ultimately on the cross. And it continues on through the New Testament in the work of the early church and down to the present day. And so for this reason, we can always talk about the relevance of the gospel to our own day and to our own lives. And as Jesus has been sort of unfolding the whole reason for his coming through his teaching, through his actions, through his interaction with his disciples, we're just getting various pieces, insights into the nature of this good news. Now, tonight we're looking at a passage, and I'm not one who's prone to exaggeration, as I'm sure you all know, but this is the greatest passage in the Gospel of Mark. It's sort of like the summary of Jesus saying in the succinctest of terms who he is and what he's about, and what does it mean then to come along and follow him. So that is just like the nutshell version of this is Christianity 101. And I'm calling it the paradox of the gospel because Jesus brings out two features of the good news that come to us as paradoxes. And by paradox, I don't mean like a contradiction. A contradiction is like today is both Sunday and not Sunday. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? That's a contradiction. That can't be true. A paradox is not a contradiction. It's a truth that's really hard to get at because we're just, you know, because the values that we serve and the way that we think and the limitations of our understanding, it's really hard to get to that place, hard to understand. So paradoxical truths, you know, they take a little work, but at the end of the day, you know, paradoxes are the greatest truths. That's why Jesus talks about the mystery of the kingdom of God. Well, when Jesus talks about what he came to do, there's paradox. And when Jesus talks about what does it mean for you and I to come follow him, there's paradox. Let's unroll that here this evening. Beginning in verse 27, Mark chapter 8, Jesus and his disciples left Galilee. They went north to Caesarea Philippi. And they were walking along, and Jesus asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" And the disciples reply, "Well, some say you're John the Baptist. You know, come back to life. Some say you're Elijah. And others say that you're one of the other prophets." And so this is where the conversation begins. Who do people say that I am? And Jesus is just, he's interested in taking inventory. He's been at it now for about 2.5 years, speaking publicly all over Israel. And so he's getting in there and he's saying to his disciples, you know, what are you hearing out there? Who do people say that I am? What are the options? Well, the popular opinion poll would say one way of looking at this is that maybe you're the forerunner of the Messiah. You're Elijah. And the informed, interested Jewish audience would, I think, find that conclusion easy to come to. Jesus is out there. He's talking about the coming of the kingdom of God. He's performing miracles and drawing huge crowds. And that's exactly the kind of thing that people had in mind when they consider what happens right before the Messiah comes. In the book of Malachi, the very end of the Old Testament, in fact, closes with this line. It says, "Behold, I'm going to send Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord." Before the history comes to an end, Elijah the prophet is going to come. Remember, Elijah is this guy in the Old Testament, a prophet. The weird thing about Elijah, he didn't die. He was just taken up into heaven. And Malachi is saying, before God's Messiah comes into the world and history comes to its conclusion, Elijah's going to come back and announce this day. And so a lot of people were thinking, well, maybe that's who Jesus is. Some were saying, well, Clearly, he's some kind of a prophet. I mean, no one can speak the things that he speaks with the authority that he has and to do the kinds of things that he does. I mean, that's just, that person's got to be from God. So maybe he's a prophet. And so they're just carrying on this conversation. Jesus changes gears then, and he says in verse 29, okay, that's great, but who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Now he's making it a little bit more personal. And he's not just asking in the abstract, you know, what do people think? What are the possible options of who I am? Now he's getting very personal, and he's saying to them, who do you say that I am? What is the verdict that you have reached about me? And Jesus is going to make this point, we're going to unroll it here in a minute, that this is a really, it's a forced option. That Christianity is all about who do you say that Jesus Christ is? Because Christianity is not about like a moral system, you know, a way of living, a philosophy of life, a religion in that sense. Christianity is Jesus Christ. It's who is he, what has he done, and how will you in a very personal way respond to his call on your life? And so that's what Jesus is getting at here, and he's calling on them. What's your verdict? Who do you say that I am? Where do you land? What ground do you stand on? And so Peter, I think speaking on behalf of the other disciples that are with him, blurts it out. He says, you are the Messiah. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And so, bingo, he's got it. Okay? For the first time, Jesus' own disciples correctly realize, sort of in a consensus way, okay, you are the guy. You're the one that we've been waiting for. And this becomes, in the narrative of Mark's gospel, the pivot point, the turning point. They're up north, and they're having this conversation. Peter makes this incredible proclamation. Yes, you're the Messiah. And now, having made that, Jesus is going to clarify what Messiah means, and he's going to clarify what does it mean to be a disciple of the Messiah, and then he's going to move slowly south, down to Jerusalem, down to the cross. And that's just the trajectory of where this is all going. And so everything begins to become more intense. Jesus is increasingly clear about who he is and what he's come to do. The antagonism of the religious establishment is increasingly acute as Jesus begins to interact with them. And the stakes could not be higher, and the cross just becomes a regular part of the conversation. This is what it's all about, and this is where it's all going. Do you want to come here too? So that's where it's heading. Now, in Peter's mind, and I think probably in the disciples' mind as well, when they say, you are the Messiah, they don't have all that in mind. What they have in mind is the fact that they are more or less amazed at who Jesus is, and they've been following him around. And they've been having these personal interactions with him. And they've seen him just do the most remarkable things. And they can only conclude that you are the Messiah. And in this sense, Peter is totally right. And he's totally clueless. He could not be more right that Jesus is the Messiah. But he has no idea what he's talking about when he says it. And so Jesus, taking this opportunity, I'm so glad you agree with me about who I am. Now let me introduce you to some paradox. Now let me give you a little bit more information about what being Messiah really is all about. And so he goes on in verse 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. See, it wasn't time to get the message out to the masses about Jesus as Messiah, because all Jesus concerned that all this would do is play into misconceptions about him, the very misconceptions that his own disciples have and that he's about to address. And so he says, then Jesus began to tell them that the Son of Man must suffer many terrible things and be rejected by the elders, the leading priests, and the teachers of the religious law. He would be killed, but 3 days later, he would rise from the dead. And so, boom, there it is. That's the messianic mission in a nutshell. And that's why I'm saying this passage is so important, because all Jesus is doing is summarizing the essence of who he is and what he has come to do. And so this summary statement can be further summarized with the one thing where he says the Son of Man must suffer. And that is the heart of the paradox about who is Jesus Christ, who is the Messiah. The paradox of Christ is that he's both the Son of Man and that he must suffer. And so, what do we mean by that? Son of Man is an expression that's used in the Old Testament. It's used in the book of Daniel, specifically in Daniel chapter 7. And it is in reference to the Old Testament's hope of King Messiah. That God was going to enter into the world in the kingly line of David, and he is going to establish his kingdom on the earth, a kingdom of irresistible power. And he will usher in a time of peace and justice on the earth. And so this is what Jesus, he uses this title in reference to himself. It's the most common designation Jesus uses for himself in all the Gospels. It's the Son of Man. And so it comes right out of this passage. It says, I kept looking in the night visions. This is Daniel talking. Behold, with the cloud of heavens, one like a Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days, which is a term for God. And he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. All the peoples, nations, and peoples of every language serve him. This dominion is everlasting and will not pass away. His kingdom will never be destroyed. And so Jesus wants his disciples to understand, you call me the Messiah, and you are right, and I am the Son of Man, and I will establish the global reign of God on the earth, and all knees will bow before me. And every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is the Messiah. Every tongue will confess this. Because it will be evident. It will be irresistible. And it's going to happen. And that is the great messianic hope of the Old Testament. But along with this very clear statement of who Messiah is, Jesus also says that the Son of Man paradoxically must suffer many things. He must, it says, suffer. It's emphatic. It's not that he will or that he might or whatever, but that he must suffer many things. So now we've got a different picture going on, a suffering Messiah, something that was evident in the Old Testament, but really, this is the paradox, so impossible to reconcile with this broader picture of the Son of Man coming in power. And so he's referring here, no doubt, to passages like this in Isaiah chapter 53, verses 4 to 8, where it says, surely, and this is talking about God's servant, the Messiah. Surely he bore our griefs and our sorrows he carried. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourgings we are healed. All of us have gone away like sheep, each to his own way. But the Lord caused all of our sin to fall upon him. And by oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who knew that he was cut off from the land of the living for the sin of my people to whom the stroke was due? Well, that is also a picture of Messiah from the Old Testament. And the commentaries of rabbis in Jesus' day are universal. This is about the Messiah. But what a different picture this is. Here is a Messiah who comes and not conquering power, but one who comes to offer his life as a sacrifice for the guilt of the people. And so we ask this question, and how can this possibly be? How could Jesus be both the conquering king and the suffering servant? And contemporary Jewish commentators held these things in tension and said, here's a paradox that can't be answered. We have to conclude that there are simply two messiahs. The King David Messiah, that's the one that we're really looking forward to. And this other guy, the suffering servant, who seems to be suffering on behalf of all of us and taking upon himself our guilt. And Jesus is saying this: there are not two messiahs, but one Messiah who comes twice. And that is the heart of Jesus' message. Jesus is saying, yes, I will return. I will come as the conquering king. But here's the problem. If I came to set up my kingdom now, nobody would be ready. No one's ready for the rule of God, a time of God's just and righteous rule over the earth. Because why? Because we're all so distant from God. We're alienated from God. You know, we stand under the judgment of God because we're guilty before him. And so God, you know, he has provided a way to deal with that problem by coming into the world and taking upon himself just exactly what Isaiah describes. Your sin, my sin, the sins of the world. You know, we can pay for these sins ourselves. And it will take forever in a Christless, godless eternity. Or we can trust that the sacrifice that Jesus made, that his blood on the cross, it pays for the sin of all sinful people, you and me. That he has dealt with that problem. You know, this is the Bible's message of grace. It says, you know, it's not what can you do for God. The real question that the Bible asks is, what has God done for you? And this is really at the heart of the message. The heart of the message is that we are guilty. And within our conscience, we know that. And we may wrestle with that a little bit. We may say to ourselves, well, at least I'm not as bad as some other person. You know, I turn on the TV, I read the newspaper, I read about all kinds of bad people. Good thing I'm not like that. And we may have even talked ourselves into this idea that, comparatively speaking, I'm a righteous guy. There's a term for that. It's called self-righteous. And Jesus says, there will be no self-righteous people in my kingdom. The only people in my kingdom are the ones that stand under my mercy and have received the gift of forgiveness and of reconciliation and are made right with God, not because they're so good, but because of the sacrifice of Christ on their behalf. Now, you may be sitting here tonight, as happens every week, and you've thought to yourself, well, I've been basically a good person, a churchgoer all my life. I'm all right. And on the one hand, you know, there is nobility in people honoring the demands of their conscience. But we're not innocent before God. And God is calling on you here tonight to make a decision. Will I choose to stand under his mercy and receive the gift of right standing before God on the basis of what Christ has done? Or will I defiantly stand before him on the basis of my merits? That's the decision that God has before every human being. That's the most important decision you will ever make in your life. How will I stand before God? On the basis of my self-righteousness or on the basis of his mercy? And it's just a very simple proposition at that point. The Bible's story really brings together the necessity that, yes, the Son of Man must suffer. He must suffer. Because in the suffering of the Messiah, we have the two pictures that really fill out who God is. But I've been reading Revelation chapter 5. We don't have time to get into it, but maybe in your own time this week, you could read through this incredible chapter where the Apostle John, and he's given this vision of heaven. And the vision centers on the Lamb on the throne who reigns forever. What a beautiful picture that is. The Lamb represents the sacrifice. Represents the fact that God loves the world so much, that He is prepared to give everything He has to meet you at your deepest place of need, your guilt before Him. See, God is not going to step aside and be blind to the righteousness and the justice and the holiness, as the Bible calls it, of His own morally perfect character. He's not going to back off on that. But because to do so, he would cease to be God. But because He loves His creation so much that He is actually prepared to take upon Himself the judgment that we deserve. That's the Lamb who reigns like the Son of Man, the Messianic King, forever. What a beautiful picture that is. A God who's approachable because He has moved toward you as far as He possibly could to demonstrate His love for you and His care for you. And He's calling you into relationship with Him as a son or a daughter. And He's saying, you take my forgiveness that I freely offer. And that changes everything. And now you stand under my watchful care as the Son of Man, as the Messianic King, as the one who has the coercive power to draw all humanity to their knees to confess that Jesus is the Lord to the glory of the Father. And that's the picture of the Messiah as it's expressed in the Old Testament. This is what Jesus is saying. That's exactly who I am. And then Peter took him aside and he began to rebuke him for saying such things. That's what I mean when I said Peter totally got it and totally didn't get it. Totally knew that Jesus was Messiah, but had no idea what that meant. What do you mean you're going to, suffer? That's not what we signed up for. We've been following you around because we thought you were going to be made king. So get it straight, Jesus. Man, can't you read your own Bible? You know, it says you're going to reign, and here now you're talking about suffering and dying? Wow, you must have like a head cold or something like that. This is one of the most remarkable verses in the Bible. Peter rebukes God. Well, the story doesn't end there, because Jesus has response, and Jesus, it says in verse 33, turned around and He looked at His disciples and rebuked Peter and says, "Get away from me, Satan! You're seeing things from a mere human point of view and not from God's." Well, here I would say would be the most strident words to any disciple that is imaginable. And God has probably got words of correction for all of us in the misconduct of our lives, but never have we read the words, "Get behind me, Satan." Wow. Now, He's not saying that Peter is Satan. It's a figure of speech. It means accuser. And what He's saying is that, you know, I'm moving toward betrayal, to suffer, and to die. And you're telling me, you got this voice in my ear saying, no, it's not supposed to go down that way. When I know that it does, and I know what's at stake. And so in His humanness, many would argue, and I think it's true, that Jesus just singles Peter out and says, "Man, you are like the devil to me. That's not what I need to hear." So I don't know what Peter did with that. I'm guessing he wrote that down. And he stuck that in his back pocket. Thought maybe it'd become useful down the line, and in fact, really it does, as we'll see next time we study the Gospel of Mark. But then Jesus goes on, and he says, okay, that's who I am, that's what I'm about, and now I want you to understand, with your eyes open now, what this forced option really is. When I say, who do you say that I am, that means something a little different now, doesn't it? Not just the triumphal king, but now that Peter has to reflect, the rest of the disciples, and us who know the whole story also need to be asking ourselves that question. Who do you say that I am? What is your verdict? Who do you say Jesus is? We said a minute ago, it remains true. Christianity is Christ. It's not a philosophy. It's not a religion. It's all about do we accept what Jesus has done for us? And are we willing to respond to that with faith? What's your verdict? You say to yourself, well, I haven't rendered a verdict yet. Okay, that's cool. That's fine. And God invites our inquiry, our investigation. Absolutely, he's laid an enormous paper trail of evidence behind so that reasonable people can look at the data, look at the information, look at the evidence, and come to a conclusion about whether or not Jesus' words about himself really are true. And we can look to the pages of the Old Testament, and we can piece it together, and we can look at history. He really did die, and he really did raise from the dead. And that's what the data shows. But at the end of the day, you need to reach a verdict. You know, to continue on month after month, year after year, sort of keeping Jesus at a safe distance is self-deceit. Is self-deceit. You will come before him. And the question is, will you come before him having accepted what he's done for you? That's the issue. You know, don't cop out. Don't say, well, Jesus, he was a good moral teacher. He was a really good guy. You know, that's just not true. No good guy says, I'm God and I'm worthy of your worship. You know, an insane person would say that. A megalomaniac would say that. A good person doesn't say that. Jesus said that. Don't say he's just a good guy. Don't say that he's a prophet from God if you're not prepared to believe what he says. Either, we put it this way, what he had to say and who he is a total absurdity. The guy is just nuts. Or this is really, really good news. Either he is the Messiah and his death did count against the balance of your sin before God, or he was a fruitcake loser who died for no purpose whatsoever. Folks, it's got to be one way or the other. Where will you stand? Where will you stand on that issue? Jesus says, not believe in some abstract sense. You know, a lot of people, again, you know, good church-going people can recite creeds. The Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed. You can maybe get into big, vast portions of the Book of Common Prayer. Or maybe you know lots of the songs and the hymns and stuff like that. You know, that's all really good. And you may call yourself a Christian in the sense that these are things that you hold to be true. Again, abstractly, impersonally. Like I believe that Mars exists or something like that. But Jesus doesn't call us to simply believe that these things are true. Jesus calls us to believe in Him. In Him. It's relational. It's will you come before me and yield your pride and your will and say, Jesus, I do trust that what you did on that cross was necessary to free me from the bondage of my sin and my guilt before God. And I want that death to count for me. Okay, that's a personal transaction. And that is exactly what Jesus is calling on Peter and the disciples and all humanity to have that interaction with Him. Not in our head, but addressing and communicating directly with God. That's what it means to be a Christian in the biblical sense. Now then, Jesus goes on, and there's a second paradox here. He says in verse 20, 34, then calling the crowd to join his disciples, he said, hey, if any of you want to be my disciple, great! He's got to turn away from his selfish ways and take up your cross and follow me. And then he defines what he's really talking about here. He gets down to the principle, the deep paradox of discipleship. He says in verse 35, if you hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel, you will save it. That, my friends, is a paradox. The paradox of discipleship. What is he saying here? He's calling for a total life reorientation. That's what discipleship is. That's what it means to follow Jesus Christ in our life. And it's deeply paradoxical. He's saying, while you may have an ingrained habit, a real passion to hang on to your life, what I'm really calling you to do is release it. To give up. To give up. He's not saying go to bed and just stay there till you die. He's saying release control of your life. Release ownership of your life. Release the demand that everything in your life is about you and your agenda and your timing and you. And he's saying, release that. Don't hang on to that. Because in hanging on to the private ownership of your life, you will lose it, he says. But paradoxically, to give it up, to surrender to God, your life, well, actually, you'll find it. You'll save it. Amazing. Lose your life, he says. What does it mean? Is this threatening or is this liberating? Well, I think the answer clearly is yes. Threatening? Oh, man. Yeah. Threatening to say, I am not the Lord God Almighty in my private universe. But I'm prepared to yield my will, my life, my agenda, what I'm about. I'm prepared to yield that to God. That is threatening. Because, you know, we're taught, you know, who do we trust? We trust ourselves. Whose resources matter? Mine. See, that's the way we're wired up to be. And Jesus is saying something that really runs at cross purposes with that agenda. And he's saying, that's not what I'm calling you to. I'm the King, and you're my servant. I'm the Lord. I'm your Creator. You're my creation. And so, yeah, I mean, there's deep threat in saying before God in an open-handed way, God, I don't know what this means. I don't really understand the implications here. I just don't know. But I trust who you are as the Lamb on His throne, as the God who loves enough to give Himself up for me. I'm prepared to just trust you with my life. Yeah, that's very threatening to our desire for self-rule. It's also deeply liberating. deeply liberating to say, oh man, it's just to place myself in the care of the Almighty God and to not be in that wrestling match with Him, but to entrust to Him who I am and to allow Him to shape me and to mold me, to experience His purpose being affected in my life, His power in my weakness. What a beautiful thing this is. So yes, it's threatening and it's liberating. And here's the wager. What are you going to bet your life on? Everybody here is betting your life on something. Jesus clarifies in the next verse. He says, what do you benefit, he says, if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? Is anything more important than your soul? Here's a deal. I'll give you $1 million right now if you just shoot yourself. Good deal? Okay, I realized that was a little fruity. 10 million. How about that? 10 million. You say, well, you're nuts. You've totally lost your mind. Well, of course, I have lost my mind. If I'm prepared to say that my life is worth anything that you could put on a dollar bill or a material thing of any sort. Here is the foolishness of humanity and alienation from God, that we worship and serve the creation rather than the Creator, as Paul says in Romans chapter 1. That we're dedicating our lives to how much stuff we can amass, and then we are measuring one another against those accumulations. And we are in the service of an ego that demands respect and identity, accomplishment, success, things, stuff. That's what makes the world go round. And Jesus is saying, man, your soul's just not worth that. God has something so much better than living for self, living for ego, living for stuff. Way better than that. See, Christ as Messiah is trustworthy of all. He's God. You know, He's able to meet our needs. He's a loving sovereign. What are we risking when we say to Him, my whole life, I want to give it to you. I don't know how to do that. You're going to have to teach me, but that's where I want to be. You know, what we'll find is that God is trustworthy in every area of our life. He will meet that need. He is that net under the high wire of our life. He's trustworthy to meet our needs. We don't have to define ourselves and pursue things that are ultimately just never enough. Never enough. But Christ also is not just trustworthy, He is worthy of all. And I love this passage so much because it just gives us this enormous picture of Jesus. He is the Son of Man. He is God made flesh. He is affecting the most important work in the history of humanity. And He is worth your life. He's not going to demand your life, but He's calling on you voluntarily as one of mine. Surrender yourself to me. Allow me to be the Lord of your life. And then we will begin to see some things that will change. Our lives, He says, that's how we save our life. That's how we find our life, as He says in another passage. That's how our life is preserved. Sozo, the word translated saved. It doesn't mean saved from eternal judgment or whatever. It means preserved. That God is cultivating the life of the soul as we give ourselves to Him. And that's how we save it. It's a real high-risk, high-reward proposition. Man, you'll deeply experience God when you deeply trust Him. You'll really experience His provision for your life when you give up the reins of your own control. High risk, high reward. And the reward, and what does it mean to save our lives? It means to have that sense of closeness with God, that peace with God. It's like, you know, we're reading off the same page. Me and God, we want the same thing. We want His purpose to be accomplished in my life. It's not a tug of war anymore, where I'm trying to do my thing and God is, you know, kind of in the way and I'm embarrassed by it. And my whole orientation to the Christian life is just kind of about duty and what I have to do or whatever. That's where your head is at, and so many of us are there. What we're saying is that you're involved in a tug of war. What you really want is to be in the driver's seat of your life, and you're not feeling that sense of closeness with God. You kind of resent in a subtle way the fact that God is God and that you're not. But as we just make that choice, that decision to entrust our lives to Him, that brings that sense of closeness, of peace. It's like the war's over. You know, maybe that's a decision that some of us really need to make tonight, that we've never really come before God like that, to say, you know, not just thanks, Lord, for being reconciled to You on the basis of the cross of Christ. I mean, that's really awesome. But I want to take this further step. I want to be a follower of Yours. I want to be a disciple. I want You to have the rights to my life. And I don't know what that means, but You're going to show me, and it's going to be awesome. And when we make those kind of interactions with God, there is that sense of peace that we really do have. That, man, we are passionate about the same thing. That the God of the universe and me are reading off the same page. Beautiful. To save our life is to be freed from our fussing. You're a fusser here tonight. And you're fussing about your stuff. And you're fussing about your retirement. And you're fussing about your health. And you're fussing about your property, and you're fussing about how people think about you, and you're fussing. You're a fusser because you're used to being the god of your own silly little cosmos, and it's making you neurotic, and it's making the people around you neurotic. You know, you're self-deceived, but you ask people close to you, am I a fusser? Oh, yeah. Man, let me tell you what a fusser you are. And so if we just have that relaxed feel, we're taking our hands off the throttle, and we're just entrusting ourselves to God, and we're prepared to go wherever God is going to be directing us, well then, you know, we just don't find that fussing really matters that much anymore. And we begin to realize that God's going to take care of the things that really matter. So there's a peace that comes there. And very importantly, and finally, a real sense of intimacy with other people. You know, when we are prepared to let God be God, and we are prepared to subordinate our lives and our will to Him, and then we can enter into other relationships with people who've made that same kind of decision. And that means then that we have this freedom to be able to involve ourselves within one another's lives, realizing that person's not there just to extract out of me what they want and to go their way. You know, just like a bug that, just like a wasp that sucks the life out of a caterpillar, just leaves this exoskeleton behind. You know, that's kind of how people are. We're parasitic in our relationships. We're selfish in that way. And so if we're willing to set aside the predatory nature of how we relate to people and always having that bottom line of what's in it for me? What are they doing for me? How's this paying off for me? And we're saying it doesn't really matter because my life is God's. Then the guard goes down and we're able to interact with other people in a like-minded way and we find, oh wow, I can give and I can receive from that person. And there's something real being built here. And you sense a level of intimacy, of connection, of closeness with another person that you have never experienced before. And it's awesome. And then you begin to realize, man, I've been trying to manipulate the world to give me this feeling my whole life. And it's never worked. And now just setting that aside and letting God be God, boom, we're there. It's awesome. That's God's way, and it's a paradox. The paradox of Christ as Messiah, the Son of Man who must suffer, and the paradox of the Christian life, that if you hang on to your life, you'll lose it, but if you give up your life, you'll save it. And if we just kind of keep it simple and keep it on that, we're going to be doing okay.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.